The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Heretics Hour on this Sunday, November 18th, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager. And I want to announce first off tonight that I'm taking some time off for Thanksgiving and Christmas. In the next week, the Heretics Hour and the International Jew and Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn will all be repeats. That's starting next Monday, not this week. Tan Stoffel will also be taking off for Thanksgiving week. And I imagine he'll let you know what time, but he will have a new program tomorrow night. And I don't think Paul will take off. Actually, I hope he doesn't want to, but of course it's always up to him if he doesn't want to do a program any particular week. So that about takes care of that. Then I am also going to be taking off the last week of December for the Christmas week. So that will be, I don't know the dates for that, but that's the week of Christmas and up to New Year. I also want to thank Paul, Carl, Gloria, Dimitar, and Andrew for recent donations. And we also got in the mail a MoneyGram from Jaime Schwartz from Brooklyn, New York, which kind of surprised me. But when I opened it, I saw there was a MoneyGram. Oh, I saw he said that. There was a MoneyGram in there, and he's listed himself there as being from Tel Aviv. but the envelope was postmarked Jacksonville, Florida. So I don't think his name is really Jaime Schwartz. And he sent a newspaper clipping, which didn't seem like something Jaime Schwartz would send. So I want to thank this person, too, and I appreciate his sense of humor. Now, some of these donations were for the White Network, and some were for me with my two sites, CarolynYeager.net and EllieWeaselTattoo.com. Just want to remind people that all of these sites rely on financial help from listeners, so your donations are very much appreciated. On Saturday, I had Peter Zykowitz on my program, and I wanted to allow him to give his views and describe his books. I really enjoyed talking with him. I have a lot of respect for him after talking with him, and he was very pleasant with me, but there is, of course, much to be in disagreement with about his view of the occupation of Poland under the National Socialists and the Wehrmacht between late 1939 and early 1945. I'm going to look into some of that as best I can. I promised him I would read the book. You know, I'm saying, well, where does this information about how the Germans treated the Poles during the occupation period, that is during the wartime, come from? Because I've never really seen any. But, well, you know, he points to archives, but he also recommended the book by Richard Lucas, The Forgotten Holocaust. And of course I'm somewhat familiar with that book, and I don't think much of it, and I told him so, but then he said I should read it, and I said, you're right, I should, and I will. And I promised, I said, you know, of course not really a promise, but I did say, you know, I will read it. So on that, you know, we parted, and now I'm looking, I still don't want to read that book after I've looked into it more. I'm debating on if I buy it. I want to buy a couple more at the same time, so I haven't done it yet. But I should see, you know, I have a disbelieving view on these people. But so I'm looking into things, and I was reminded of the Alfred Schickel essay that was translated on Hasso Kastrup's site, Show a Blogger, sometime back. You know, it's been on there for quite a while. In fact, I wanted to do a show about it with Hasso, but then he preferred to talk about the Ilya Ehrenberg, who he had just translated a bunch of his stuff. So we talked about that. And so I went back to the Schickel essay, and I was reading it, and I thought, this is really, I want to bring out the highlights and the what's been important points in this essay. And so I'm doing that tonight. And of course, it's not about the occupation time. It's about the lead up to the declaration of war. And it's, that turned into the Second World War, turned into so much more than it ever should have. And this has been talked about quite a bit. I've even covered it. I've covered the Pataki papers and all of that. But I think, I just see some things in here that are important to emphasize and bring out. So that's what I'm going to be trying to do with reading from this essay. And, I'm starting out with, this is pretty much the beginning of it. A middle-sized state, Alfred Schickel is a revisionist historian, German. And he started a history institute in Germany, and he's still living, so he's still involved in it, I hope. I don't know how, I forget his date of birth. It's probably way down at the bottom of this, but he has to be fairly old now. But he's been, he's one of the kind of historians, and he's working in Germany, that we really need, and I really should, really can appreciate. And so he is the one who did the research on this. And he starts out, a middle-sized state like the Republic of Poland saw, before the outbreak of the Second World War, ambassadors, senators, or deputies as important political figures. This was evident, for example, in the private visit, quote-unquote, of the ambassador William C. Bullitt in Warsaw. The Polish newspapers reported on the arrival, stay, and activities of the American visitor and presented him to their readers as a private person. After all, he was the fourth prominent American who has visited Warsaw in the recent time. This was what was in the papers. After Governor Earle, would it be an American governor, Congressman Lambeth and Senator Guffey, as the Warsaw newspaper Express Porani on 14 November 1937 wrote. Although he came only as a personal friend of the United States ambassador to Poland, Drexel Biddle, and had no official functions on the Vistula, that means, you know, it's what they call the official government of Poland, in Warsaw, just like we talk about on the Potomac, I guess, in Washington, D.C. or something. His former position as secretary to the president, Woodrow Wilson, now we're talking about Bullitt now, he goes back so far that for so long that he was a secretary to President Woodrow Wilson, as well as his current position as the U.S. ambassador in Paris, was sufficient in the eyes of the Poles to give him such attention and also to report that, quote, Ambassador Bullitt is a widower and has a 15-year-old daughter who is equally known for her beauty and intelligence. Things like that that they like to write in the paper about elites like Bullitt. So now Bullitt was currently the ambassador to France from the United States, and Biddle was the U.S. ambassador to Poland. And goes on, the official Poland also took note of his American guest from Paris, which was expressed in an interview with the Polish foreign minister Joseph Beck on 16 November of 1937, followed by a dinner, quote, in honor of Mr. Bullitt. So Joseph Beck, the Polish foreign minister, gave a dinner in honor of Ambassador Bullitt, but who was there only as a, what did they say? He was there as like just a private citizen. This may be read in the relevant secret reports of the U.S. Embassy in Warsaw in November 1937. Bullitt was considered a friend of President Roosevelt And that's important. He was a friend. Everybody knew he was a friend of Roosevelt and enjoyed the reputation of, quote, one of the most outstanding professionals in foreign policy, unquote, who was also closely connected to U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull. Bullitt belonged to the circle of personal friends and advisors of Roosevelt, who liked to address him as, quote, my dear Bill Buddha. Buddha spelled B-U-D-D-H-A. I guess he was supposed to be so wise. His first assignment was head of mission of the United States in the Soviet Union in late autumn 1933. That is, Roosevelt was the first to recognize the Soviet Union, and United States opened an embassy there, and Bullitt was put in charge. He was the ambassador to the Soviet Union. From 1933 until 1936, in 1936, he headed the U.S. Embassy in Paris and would remain at this post until 1941. That's all important background, a little more background here. His visits and appearances always attracted attention and had never merely strictly private character. There was always something official about them. This was apparent also on his short visit in mid-November 1937 in Warsaw. Not for nothing, the Polish Foreign Minister Beck met three times with the, quote, private guest, quote, from Paris, that is Bullitt, and led a private conversation with him, as the American Embassy report dated 17 November 1937 shows. Drexel Biddle's report shows that Joseph Beck invited himself to a dinner at the U.S. Embassy on 17th November, which was, quote, a lovely and interesting opportunity with frank and confidential conversation, unquote. The essence of the conversations conducted by Bullitt was eventually reflected in four confidential memoranda, which the U.S. Ambassador Biddle, together with his summary report of 26 November 1937, sent as strictly confidential to Secretary Hull. The Memorandum A was concerned with developments in Soviet Russia and with, quote, cleansing, unquote, performed by Stalin. The Memorandum B concerns itself especially with the German-Czech relations, as well as with anti-Semitism in Central and Eastern Europe. According to the report, Beck expressed himself as decisively in contradiction to the belief of Bullitt that France would march as a response to a German attack on Czechoslovakia, mainly because of its internal political situation. Beck's opinion was the absence of a response to Hitler's Rhineland occupation, that France had already shown in 1936 her weakness and thus indicated her future attitude towards similar events. Correspondingly, Poland also reconsidered her relationship to the German Reich, which meant that if Germany demanded autonomy for her people in Czechoslovakia, Poland was going to take care of her minority in Teschen area. And I'm sure you're familiar enough with that, but we'll have more on that coming up. The strictly confidential Memorandum C of the U.S. Embassy reflects the evaluation of the situation by the Polish Marshal Rydz Smigli that he had given in a conversation with Foreign Minister Beck, Ambassador Biddle, and Ambassador Bullitt. It culminated in the finding that neither the French nor the Russians were at the moment in a position to conduct a military intervention, in which Rydz Smigli was in complete agreement with his foreign minister, that is, with Beck. Ambassador Biddle noted this in his record, that they believed that the French nor the Russians were in a position to conduct a military intervention at the time. So that's going to be why he was making friendly. With Germany at that time. In the fourth Memorandum D, Bullitt and Biddle noted the Polish great power ambitions, and described Warsaw's, or rather Foreign Minister Beck's, ideas about the role of Poland as the, quote, third Europe, unquote, in the east of the continent. It would establish itself not only as a great power and dominate the region from the Baltic to the Black Sea, but also keep a self-confident distance from the Soviet Union and the German Reich, a policy that would bring Washington's interest and applause because they, Washington, defied, the Poles defied both the Bolshevik dictatorship and the Nazi regime and laid great weight on Roosevelt's European policy. I'm really not sure Roosevelt's European policy was officially. I was going to look that up and I never did get around to it. Okay, the conversation and diplomatic talks between Bullitt and the Poles in Paris and Washington in November 1938 and early 1939 illustrated the intention of Roosevelt to assure Poland any assistance against a possible German threat to prevent another aggression of the Nazi Reich in Eastern Europe. So, the intention of Roosevelt to assure Poland assistance. What assistance were they going to be able to give, and what assistance did they give? Well, we'll see. At the time of Bullitt's visit, however, the German-Polish relations seemed neither hostile nor strained. On the contrary, Berlin and Warsaw had just a few days before the arrival of the top American diplomat concluded a minority agreement, which was suitable to reducing the existing stress of the mutual relations. In connection with this agreement, on the same day, the 5th November 1937, this is late 37, Chancellor Hitler in Berlin received a representative of the Union of Poles in Germany and the Polish President Mosicki, a delegation of the German minority in Poland, as a demonstration of mutual understanding. And what the attitude of Warsaw to the German-Czech tensions was that hardly any friendly feelings toward Prague. That is, Warsaw had hardly any friendly feelings toward Prague after the beginning of translation is just hasn't been edited. At the beginning of 1937, a book was released by the Czechoslovak envoy in Bucharest, Jan Seba. It was called Russia and the Little Entente, in which the author stood up for a common border between Czechoslovakia and the Soviet Union. For, as one pointed out in Warsaw, this was at Poland's expense. So it's just pointing out that there was tension between the Poles and the Czechs, and the Poles were being friendly with Germany, or not hostile at all to Germany, as Germany was going through its relations with Czechoslovakia and all that entailed. So Schickel writes, Czech Foreign Minister Krafta had written a preface in this book that was not friendly to Poland. And this also was seen as something that the Poles didn't like. And it is well known that Berlin would a year later, I should read this whole thing. He wrote, the Czech Foreign Minister wrote a preface in the book, furthering Prague in her role as a vanguard of the Soviet Union in the event of war. So the Czechoslovakia was being very friendly with the Soviet Union in its trying to figure out who would be its best ally here. And so Poland was going in the other direction. And it is well known, Schickel writes, that Berlin would, a year later, harbor the same suspicion against Czechoslovakia that it was too friendly with Moscow. And it spoke of Berlin spoke of a conscious coalition of Prague and Moscow. So early in Yeah, it got pushed up again. Ay, ay, ay. Early January 1938, the Polish foreign minister, who is Beck, was staying for a few days in Berlin and was received by both Hitler and the Reich foreign minister and other leading German statesmen. And when in March 1938, in the wake of Austria's annexation to Germany, the Anschluss, Poland has not taken the example. Okay, foreign missions in Vienna were closed. Oh, yeah, I know what this is. And so in the wake of Austria's annexation to Germany, the foreign missions in Vienna were closed because it was no longer Austria, see? It was, and so the missions to Austria were not viable anymore. And they said that Poland did not follow the example of Bulgaria or Switzerland, which converted their current embassies to consulates general, but actually dissolved her diplomatic mission without replacement, which best corresponded to the German desires. So they were doing everything, in a friendly fashion for Germany more than anybody else at this time, early 1938, and in March 1938, when the Anschluss took place. With the Sudeten crisis looming, Warsaw still preserved benevolent neutrality towards Berlin and was sometimes pronounced Germanophile, although the former prime minister and defense minister, General Sikorsky, according to the American Embassy report of 4 November 1937, in a much publicized essay, had expressed himself for the course, quote, neither Germany nor Russia, unquote, and anti-German feelings began to appear in army circles. So, does this mean that Beck was challenged by the army, I ask, because Hasso Kastrup, who is the translator of this, and is half Polish and half German, is still making the argument that Beck would have been assassinated had he continued to go along with the Germans, that's why he made the switch. Although I have to say, if you're for the best interests of your nation, if you're a total patriot and you think that this is in the best interest of your nation, you'd do it whether there was a threat of you being assassinated or not, in my opinion, because Adolf Hitler was attempted assassinations on him several times, which he found out, he knew about, and sometimes found out about later. But that didn't stop him from doing what he was doing ever, and he always knew that he could be killed at any time. And he had this fortunate luck or something else that caused him to leave the scene or something, before the intent, before the action was going to take place. So, but anyway, this is the argument that he makes, that Beck was what it would have been. And maybe it was the army, because he says here the army was becoming more and more anti-German, so they would not have appreciated the foreign minister's friendliness or, siding with Germany at this time, if this is true. Well, that's just one little thing that came to my mind as I read that. Now, Schickel goes on, the Polish government remains suspicious of latent, and actually I'm not reading word for word here, I'm leaving some things out and I'm taking what is most important, although it sounds, trying to make it sound like it kind of goes along smoothly. The Polish government remains suspicious of latent sympathy for communism in Czechoslovakia and protested to Prague on 30th March 1938 against the anti-Polish activities of members of the Comintern and the Communist Party. I think they mean in Czechoslovakia, on the border with Poland, and was not entirely satisfied by the Czech reply. So more of this Polish-Czech tensions, and too much friendly Czech. The Czechs were definitely over-friendly with the Soviet Union. The Polish public criticized the minority policy of the Prague government and called for autonomy for the Polish minority in Czechoslovakia and, quote, compensation for the losses which the Polish population had suffered since 1918, similar to the demands in Berlin against the Czech government in those months. So just as Berlin was protesting against the treatment of the Sudeten Germans by the Czechs, Poland took the opportunity at the same time to join in and ask for, complain about how the Poles that were in Czechoslovakia, there was a Polish population, particularly in the area of what's called Teschen, that they were similarly suffering, and they wanted compensation for that. Then, in the military sphere, there were tensions between Prague and Warsaw, just as between Berlin and Czechoslovakia. That is same thing. Poles and Czechs accused each other of aggressive troop concentrations on the border. Prague explained her troop movements in the border area with domestic political needs, saying that their intention was to influence local elections, and that's why they were doing that. But when the question was discussed in May 1938, whether France should stand by its ally, Czechoslovakia, in the event of a military... Now, this is France coming in. France is allied with Czechoslovakia, and whether they should stand by it in event of a military conflict with Germany, Warsaw made it bluntly clear that it did not feel obliged in such a case to go to war on the side of France and Czechoslovakia. So this is a pretty bold statement of toleration and even a sort of a friendship with Germany, feeling that they'd rather be on the side of Germany than on the side of France and Czechoslovakia. And, you know, France and Poland had a history of being allies. Poland always considered France its best friend in Europe, really, and for many years. I don't know how many years, but so this was something noticeable. And what is more, while the German Reich became, because of the escalating Sudeten crisis, was threatened with a conflict with France and Britain, and the Soviet Union signaled its willingness to help the Czechoslovak Republic, the Warsaw government agreed with Berlin over a uniform presentation of history in school textbooks and agreed on 1st July 1938 with the Reich government that those periods in which the two countries were in opposition to each other should be represented objectively and dispassionately, and that in particular all expressions and phrases should be avoided that may seem offensive or demeaning to the other country. So there again, they are having these agreements about textbooks and, you know, how they should not be, showing the other in a demeaning manner. And they did agree on that. And so on 20th September 1938, the Polish ambassador in Berlin, Joseph Lipski, explained to the German chancellor the attitude of his government, demonstrating the concordance between Berlin and Warsaw on the Czechoslovak question. So even the Polish ambassador was talking to Hitler and telling him that, he was showing a lot of agreement and friendliness and so on between Berlin and Warsaw on this question. On 21 September 1938, the day of the Czech declaration of transfer of the Sudetenland, the Polish, now this was, you know, the Munich Agreement, and this had all been agreed to by the Western powers with Germany, and Italy was involved. And so this was taking place on September 21st, 1938. And the Polish government requested in a note to Prague that, quote, that they, quote, expected similar rules for the Polish nationals as laid down for the territory with German population. That is, namely, the transfer that they wanted the same thing for themselves as the Germans were getting. And this is, you know, what we see here is that Poland saw its advantage because it had all these frictions with Czechoslovakia, with the Czechs mainly, and they had these Polish, they had this interest in the Tetchen area, which was under Czech control. And as they saw, as Germany was using its much greater power and competence to maneuver to get the Sudeten German area under its back into the under German control and things like that, they saw their advantage to get these the same thing for their Polish population in the Czech in the Czechoslovak state, and so they were doing what was in their own interest here. And they were using, you could say they were making nice with Germany while all this was going on. At the same time, the Warsaw Polish Czechoslovak abrogated the convention of 1925 on the status of the Polish population in the CSR, and Poland issued a protest to France and Britain because they, in their transfer recommendation, had ignored the Polish minority in Czechoslovakia. So now they had done this, but they had ignored this Polish minority, and so the Poles were unhappy with France and Britain because of that, and they were protesting. And he writes, on 22 September 1938, the Polish government set up a volunteer corps for the liberation of Poles in Czechoslovakia and forbade a sharp démarche of 23rd September 1938 any interference of Moscow in favor of the Czechoslovak leadership, which the Soviet Deputy People's Commissar for Foreign Affairs had hinted to the Polish chargé. What does this say? So, again, Poland was being actually assisted by what Germany was doing at that time, which was seen by so many as aggression, and later, you know, Poland was calling Germany an aggressor, but it was not concerned about it at this time, because it was wanting to be a part of this aggressive movement to get back its population. So some supplemental statements to the Munich Agreement of Chamberlain, Daladier, Hitler and Mussolini, there were supplemental statements to this Munich Agreement, and it stated, the heads of governments of the four powers declared that the problem of the Polish and Hungarian minorities in Czechoslovakia, if it is not settled within 3 months, will be the subject of another meeting of heads of government of the four powers. So this supplemental statement is saying that this problem of the Polish and Hungarian minorities has to also be settled. And this was what Poland managed to get accomplished there. And it went on, His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom and the French government have joined the above agreement on the basis that they will offer an international guarantee of the new frontier of the Czechoslovak state against unprovoked attack. It says that once the question of Polish and Hungarian minorities is regulated in Czechoslovakia, Germany and Italy will in turn give a guarantee to Czechoslovakia. So they, you know, what was left of Czechoslovakia was being guaranteed after these populations were given their freedom or their right of self-determination or something. Thus, it says, Poland not only ran and achieved her own Munich, but also obtained a connection to the Quadripartite Agreement of 29 September and broadly along the lines of the Berlin policy, often with the same procedure. That is simply that, you know, they took advantage of that and got their interests taken care of at the same time that Germany did, although it was Germany that did all the work to and use its influence and its I'll just stick with that, its influence to bring this about. Now, it said, Schickel says, the U.S. government saw the analogy between Warsaw and Berlin with increasing discomfort and responded in two ways. I don't know if analogy is the right word, but the approachment, the friendship between Warsaw, the similar goals between Warsaw and Berlin, this was uncomfortable to the United States government. Statements of Roosevelt at a press conference on 30th September 1938, after this, all that I've just been talking about, and the statements of Secretary of State Hulls, let it be known through diplomatic channels that it considered Munich as Munich in quotes, Munich, the Munich Agreement, as a capitulation of democratic states and as a sign of their weakness against the German Reich, and by the same secret diplomatic channels, it strengthened Poland's back against any subsequent German territorial claims. Well, now here we have the interference from outside. After Britain and France had agreed to this, and Britain, France, Italy, and Germany had agreed to all of this, and then the United States comes along afterwards, it's really unhappy that this all came out this way. And it says, that this was a bad thing, a sign of weakness against the German Reich, which it sees as something negative in Europe. And according to its European ideas, and it and here's where it says where it came out that they wanted to strengthen Poland's back against any subsequent against German claims. The famous statement that in these secret documents that the United States wanted to stiffen the spine of the Poles against giving in to Germany's demands, and it wanted to put some iron up their spine. Well, Hasso Kastrup says that the actual statement says they wanted to put iron up their ass. And I said, oh, they wouldn't say that. He says, yes, they do. Yes, they did. But they've changed, moderated it so it says put iron up their spine. Well, I don't know what the truth is, but that sounds pretty funny to me. So going on with Schickel, 19th November 1938, William Bullitt met with the Polish ambassador in Washington after the United States had made these statements that this Munich was a capitulation. And so Bullitt met with the Polish ambassador in Washington, Count Jerzy Potocki. So he went back to Washington and talked with the Polish ambassador to the United States, Potocki, and he was able to continue the exchange. Began in Warsaw a year ago, so he had been talking with him in Poland a year before, but now he was picking up on these conversations again. And he also had a relative, Bullitt did, Jerzy Potocki had a relative named Joseph Potocki, who was in the Department of Anglo-Saxon, whatever that means, in the Polish Foreign Ministry. So Jerzy was in Washington, D.C. as the ambassador, and his relative was in the foreign ministry in Warsaw, I guess. And why that's important, I never have gotten real clear, but that was mentioned. And the U.S. Ambassador to France, well, no, forget that. He is the U.S. Ambassador to France. Bullitt spoke about Germany and Chancellor Hitler with Potocki. With the greatest, this is what Potocki has in his report. Bullitt spoke about Germany and Chancellor Hitler with the greatest vehemence and strong hatred, and said that only force and possibly a war may make an end to the insane German expansion of the future. Well, what I'm seeing here is that Britain, France, and of course Italy was a kind of an ally then with Germany, but these four nations agreed to the Munich Agreement. And they wanted peace. They didn't want war. But the one who was really angry about it was the United States. And so then right after that, you know, Bullitt gets in the act here, and he's speaking with vehemence and hatred, saying that only force and possibly a war may make an end to the insane German expansion in the future. Those are his exact words. That's a quote. To Pataki's question on how Bullitt imagined a future war against Germany, Bullitt said, quote, that especially the United States, France, and England would have to arm in order to be able to face the German power, unquote. Further, Bullitt reported to Ambassador Pataki, quote, that the democratic states needed another 2 years to complete their arms programs, unquote. In the meantime, Germany would probably go forward with her expansion in the eastern direction. That's what they thought. It would be the desire of democratic states that it came to an armed conflict in the east between Germany and Russia, unquote. That, where did that one start? But anyway, that was the desire of the democracies, that there be war between Germany and Russia. After the outbreak of this war, continued Bullitt, Germany would be too far removed from her base and condemned to a long and attenuating war. Only then would the democratic states attack Germany and force her to capitulation, unquote. So this was, these were his words, that what they were looking forward to was to defeat Germany and to bring Germany to a point of capitulation, to destroy Germany, as it's always been said in our revisionist history, and it was what was desired in World War One and also in World War Two. But this is coming strongly from the United States at this time, not so much from the European nations. Now, another quote from Bullitt. To Pataki's question whether the United States, no, this is from the report. To Pataki's question whether the United States would participate in such a war against Germany, Bullitt replied, quote, undoubtedly yes, but only after England and France strike first. So already then there was this plan that Roosevelt had, that he wanted England and France to declare war on Germany, which is what they eventually did. And then they would later the United States would come in. On the situation and role of Poland, the top U.S. diplomat said, quote, that is, Bullitt said, that Poland would also join in the fight if Germany overstepped her boundaries. So they were speaking for Poland. Bullitt was speaking for Poland, that Poland would also fight Germany. Which was undoubtedly meant as an encouragement and a compliment to Beck, to Poland via Pataki. The Bullitt remarks about Warsaw's quest to get a border with Hungary, Warsaw hoped to get rid of Czechoslovakia altogether and then their new border, because Hungary was also expanded a little bit by that, Munich Agreement, after the Munich Agreement, when both Poland and Hungary took the areas that were dense with their own people in them, then Poland's desire was to end up with their border with Hungary without any Czechoslovakia there. And, so to this, Bullitt said, I understand the question of a common frontier with Hungary very well. The Hungarians are also a capable people. A common defense line with Yugoslavia would facilitate the opposition to the German expansion. See, he keeps saying that Germany wanted to expand, was going to continue expanding, and that they needed to stop it, and they needed all these countries to join together to stop it. And he said that finally reached a self-evident character of encouragement in his comments about German intentions in Ukraine when Bullitt said, quote, that Germany had a complete Ukrainian staff which would in the future take over the government of Ukraine and establish an independent Ukrainian state under German influence. Now, here he is saying things he doesn't know and probably were not true when he's telling Potocki and the Poles that Germany has a Ukrainian staff that's capitalized, which had been created to take over the government of Ukraine at some future time and establish an independent Ukrainian state under German influence. Well, at this time, Ukraine was still under Russian control. So now, according to this Pataki report, Bullitt then said literally, quote, "Such a Ukraine would, of course, be very dangerous for you, as it would have a direct effect on the Ukrainians in eastern Poland." And the Poles and the Ukrainians had been enemies, had been at odds, had been the nationalists of both states, had been in lots of fights and battles and killed many of one another. And so here Bullitt is playing one against the other and telling Poland that this that if Germany takes over Ukraine, that would be very bad for them in eastern Poland, because then the Ukrainians who didn't care for the Poles that much would be working with the Germans. Now, since it was known and was noted by Ambassador Pataki in the secret report right at the outset that Bullitt was one of the most influential and closest friends of Roosevelt, great importance was attached to these messages, and they were regarded as thoughts of the president. The more so because the same man, Bullitt, spoke in the same way to the Polish ambassador in Paris, Count Julius Lukasiewicz, and tried to boost Poland's courage against Germany in February 1939. So again, Bullitt was very instrumental here in trying to convince the Poles to stop being friendly with the Germans, see the Germans as a dangerous enemy, and boost their courage to stand firm against any further German requests for, for agreements between the two nations. These objections of the United States government against existing policy of the European powers and their massive influence on the Warsaw state leadership could explain the almost abruptly changing Polish attitude toward Germany. This is what Schickel says, because it was abrupt. The German foreign policy had since October 1938 turned to the problem of Danzig, the German foreign policy had, which was expressed in two meetings between Foreign Minister Ribbentrop and Lipsky. According to the German proposals, the Free State, administered by the League of Nations, should return to Germany, and Poland should, in compensation, receive certain rights in the Danzig harbor. I hope that's all clear. In addition, Berlin wished an extraterritorial Autobahn belonging to Germany and an equally extraterritorial multi-track railroad through the corridor between Pomerania and East Prussia. Of course, they wanted it extraterritorial. They wanted it to be under their control. They wanted this corridor to belong to Germany, so that it couldn't be taken away from them or anything like that, and they could defend it and what have you. But it says but the Polish side would not accept these proposals. As things had been going, it was normal for Hitler to expect by now that Poland would be agreeable to some of this, and that Hitler was promising a lot of things, making a lot of concessions to Poland in order to get Poland to agree to the Danzig and the corridor issues, which would not have harmed Poland really at all. But now suddenly Poland was very unreceptive to all of this. So, says neither Hitler during his conversation with Beck, nor Ribbentrop on his state visit to Warsaw in January 1939, could achieve a promise from the Polish government. Poland apparently did not consider the Danzig problem negotiable and did not have the slightest hint of a willingness to discuss this issue. Suddenly, they didn't even want to discuss it. And it is natural to see this intransigence in the context of Bullitt's talks in Washington and Paris. So, you know, after being so friendly with Germany, as I've already said, during the Czech-Munich agreement to get what they wanted there, they now turned cold. The which would be enough to irritate the Germans, I would think. Now, going on, the Polish foreign minister told Ambassador Biddle about his conversations with Hitler and Ribbentrop in January in Berchtesgaden. This was Beck, Polish foreign minister Beck, met with Hitler and Ribbentrop in January, and then he told Biddle about his conversations with Hitler and Ribbentrop. And he said that the German chancellor was quite angry about President Roosevelt's message to Congress of 4 January 1939. The passage of Roosevelt's congressional message, which caused Hitler's anger, was, this is according to Beck, quote, Roosevelt said, said in his message to Congress, words may be futile, but war is not the only means of commanding a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. There are many methods short of war, but stronger and more effective than mere words, of bringing home to aggressor governments the aggregate sentiments of our own people. At the very least, we can and should avoid any actions or any lack of action which will encourage, assist, or build up an aggressor. Well, according to the secret report by Biddle, Beck and his government were deeply impressed by these statements of Roosevelt and drew the conclusion that Poland and France must soon agree on their position against Germany, since they sat in the same boat. Well, you know, Hitler was angry about being called an aggressor. And he was angry about being described in that way. And what was the other one? That must be further down. Okay. So the U.S. ambassador found the attitudes so important that he reported on it in a strictly confidential cable to Washington dated 20 February 1939. His informants in this case were American military attaché in Warsaw, Major Colburn, and the Romanian ambassador in Poland. So the Bullitt reported confidentially to Washington what he had heard from the American military attaché in Warsaw, Major Colburn, and something from the Romanian ambassador in Poland. And the Polish officer circles, we're back to that again, the military, the Polish officer circles viewed the currently observed calming in the German-Polish relations as a temporary respite which would sooner or later be followed by new German attacks, which could potentially result in a violent confrontation between Poland and Germany. So you see how it is here. We have, there's a calm in the German-Polish relations, but Bullitt is in there and using other people who will, you know, somewhat cooperate, whether they know they are or not, in stirring things up and insisting and sending messages that that this is only temporary, that this can't last, that Germany's going to come up with new attacks and new demands, you know. And so he says, Polish government circles, according to Biddle, now it's this might have been Biddle who's saying this too. Biddle is the U.S. ambassador to Poland. According to Biddle, Polish government circles expressed growing antipathy towards Germany. Yeah, He says so. According to a source, only the Polish Minister of Justice, Grabowski, was still considered German-friendly. Foreign Minister Beck was not a sympathizer of Berlin now, suddenly, even if just a few weeks previously he showed considerable friendliness towards Hitler and Ribbentrop. This is what Biddle wrote. Now, there were some anti-German demonstrations that took place in March, which were allowed. They weren't real serious, but they were students and people, I don't know, who were supposedly doing this. And probably in Warsaw. And however, going on, the Warsaw government took the German occupation of the Rump Czechoslovakia on 15 March 1939 quietly. And already on 16 March, granted the now independent Slovakia Poland's diplomatic recognition. That is, when Germany occupied the rump of Czechoslovakia in March 1939, the Warsaw government didn't vocalize any protest or say anything. It was very quiet about it. And it granted the new independent Slovakia, which was because the Slovaks pulled away from the Czechs too. It granted them Poland's diplomatic recognition immediately. So we'll stop there and come back to complete this after the break, and hope to get also to the art looting that I very much want to talk about a little bit tonight. So now we go to our music tonight is German swing music. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. That was the Golden Seaman Orchestra. And I am Carolyn Yeager, bringing you the Heretics Hour on November 18th, 2013. And the topic that I'm on is the United States attitude toward Poland and Germany, Poland-German relations, which was to encourage a lack of any agreement between the Germans and the Poles on the issues that were important to both nations, and these nations are neighbors with a common boundary, you know. And so going on, in contrast as to what I said that the, or what Schickel is saying, that the, I'm using Alfred Schickel's essay here, that the Polish government was very quiet about the German takeover of the rump of Czechoslovakia in March 1939. While contrasted to this, the American government denounced in sharp words the action of Germany and refused to recognize the legality of the de facto takeover of Bohemia and Moravia by Germany. Undersecretary of State Sumner Wells declared on 18th March 1939 to the media, and Sumner Wells was a favorite of Roosevelt's. It says here he was Undersecretary of State at the time. They declared to the media that the U.S. government's the U.S. government's regret over the actions of Germany, that, quote, it was the temporary demise of the freedom of an independent and free people with which the American people maintained close and friendly relations, unquote. And spoke in this context of, oh, here it is, spoke in this context of the making the protectorates of Bohemia and Moravia under Germany as armed attack and arbitrary acts. Now, the term temporary demise may have been chosen especially for the ears of the Czechs, and particularly their president, who was totally demolished by all this. Of course, he had to go to London because he was no longer able to rule, could be the president of his nation there. They could, of course, also have been understood, these words, temporary demise, as a hidden indication of future American intervention policy. The decisive tone of the statement is, in any case, could not be misunderstood, and soon found its echo in Warsaw. Because the Americans, so far away and with nothing to lose in this whole thing, speaks with this great decisiveness, and they're trying to, they did want to encourage Poland to follow suit, and they managed, and Poland seems to have done that. So it goes on, Ambassador Biddle's strictly confidential secret telegram of 29 March 1939. This is very important. This is Ambassador Biddle now, not Bullitt. He's the ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Poland. He sent this secret telegram to the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull. In it, he reproduced the substance of his conversation with Foreign Minister Beck of 28 March. It revolved mainly around the German-Polish relations and the determination of Warsaw not to give in to any pressure on the part of the Reich. Poland's defensive preparedness would constitute a dignified, polite, but firm response to specific suggestion of Berlin. Although Poland was for any understanding on the basis of, this is not very well, and I don't think I even need to read that part, it was agreed upon to maintain for the time being the current state of mobilization till the current international danger was gone. So they were encouraging Poland not to give in to any pressure on the part of the Reich, and to maintain this dignified, polite, but firm response to any suggestions from Berlin, and to say that for Poland to stand and to say that they would, you know, they were for any understanding on the basis of equality, but they were not accessible for a solution that would be forced upon them, right, by intimidation. So they were, you know, this was what they manufactured ahead of time, that they were all for equality, but not for intimidation. And then later on, when Germany offered total equality in the negotiations and offered all kinds of things to Poland, the Polish response was just this, a repeat of this, saying, well, you know, we're for things that are on the basis of equality, as though they weren't even paying attention to what was actually being offered to them, because they were just mouthing this statement that had been formulated earlier in March by the Americans. Therefore, it was agreed upon. Well, therefore the Poles agreed to maintain, for the time being, their current state of mobilization. They had partially mobilized their army until this current international danger was gone, they said. So, according to Ambassador Biddle, Berlin was, during those weeks, this is more of what he wrote, Berlin was power drunk and not used to encountering resistance. German political extremists would harass Hitler to enforce the quickest possible annexation of Danzig and also to achieve the rights of passage through the corridor. This is not what happened, though. According to Biddle's report, Marshal Ritz Smigley was convinced that Berlin was out to provoke a war with Poland, but the firm attitude of the Polish government enjoyed a full support of the people. And should they, as in the case of Danzig, give in, that would not only be a sign of defeatism, but would also lead to the overthrow of the government and thus also of Beck. Now, this is Ritz Smigley, and almost everything he's ever said seems to be way off base. But he said that if Poland should give in at all in the question of Danzig, should come into an agreement, you know, that would be mutually, you know, acceptable to both sides, that would be a sign of defeatism. And he says it would also lead to the overthrow of the government and thus also of Beck. So here's another threat to Beck coming up that makes me think of what Hasso Kastrup was saying, that if Beck didn't go along with what the army, again, Marshal Ritz Smigley is representing, he's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Poland. If he didn't go along with what they wanted, he would have been assassinated, or at least his government would have been kicked out. And I guess it seems to me that in that case, Beck is more interested in his own career than he is in what he sincerely thought was best for Poland. But anyway, according to Biddle's report, the German-Polish conflict could have been prevented if Berlin and Warsaw agreed to a clear change in the status of Danzig, and Berlin would settle on a right-of-way through the corridor, but not an extraterritorial status. That is, that Poland would just allow Berlin to travel through on a certain right-of-way to get to its East Prussia, which is part of Germany, and then they could just, and there would be no more further issues about it. That they would leave Danzig the way it was, and Berlin would get it right away, but not an extraterritorial ownership of it. It is suggested in a secret report by two British diplomatic emissaries who in May 1939 undertook a fact-finding visit to Poland on behalf of their government and conferred with key politicians in the military in Warsaw. The Polish interlocutors averred that regarding Danzig, there were certain concessions which no Poles would make voluntarily, and that they could not understand that that Englishmen spoke of legitimacy of the claims of Herr Hitler, and that they would ask, let me interpret this a little bit. There was a secret report in May 39. From two British diplomatic emissaries who were sent on a fact-finding visit to Poland. And they conferred with key politicians and the military in Warsaw. And they said that regarding Danzig, there were certain concessions. Okay, the Poles told them that regarding Danzig, there were certain concessions which no Poles would make voluntarily, and that they could not understand that Englishmen spoke of, quote, the legitimacy of the claims of Herr Hitler. Because Britain at that time, and many other peoples, understood that Germany had legitimate claims in this Danzig corridor issue. And that was basically, that was a British position, at least part of the British officialdom, and that the Poles then asked what were the Germans actually doing in Prague? Like, suddenly they thought the Germans had no business being there, whereas during that time that was all going on, they didn't say a word against it. But now suddenly they're saying, well, what the heck are the Germans doing in Prague? Why should they be there? And they also told the British delegation that they knew better how to deal with the Germans than did the English. But this was pretty much ignored, this fact-finding visit. And 2 days after this, the American embassy, British Prime Minister Chamberlain declared on March 31st, 1939, that, I don't know, this was in May. Okay, sorry about that. 2 days after sending the American embassy report, whatever that is, the British Prime Minister Chamberlain declared on March 31st, 1939 at London's House of Commons that the British government is committed to lend Poland all the assistance in their power if it should be attacked. And they made it clear that the attack, especially if the attack aimed at the destruction of Polish independence, so that the Polish government would have no choice but to fight back with all the national resources. And they said, we have given the Polish government the appropriate assurances. Well, you know, this was given, and then it was confirmed in August. And now we're at that a first step to mobilize Poland's National Defense Force was done on 28th March 1939. And they issued a national defense bond for the purpose of expansion of the air defenses and air force in a total of 1.2 billion zloty. And General Swarzynski on the same day stated that Germany, by the invasion of the rest of Czechoslovakia, created with a fait accompli, which has brought Poland without a doubt in a serious situation. So it really was the Polish military that was really gunning for war against Germany. And Beck either was out of step with the military, or he just played his cards during the time of the Czech crisis to gain the Tetchen from the Czech deal, you know, that was carried, as I already said, it was carried out by Berlin. And in the shadow of Germany, it got what it needed from there, and it never complained about what Germany was doing. But now that's all said and done, now it's they're seem to be dancing to this steps of the United States. But it could be that the military in Poland was just like that. It was just wanted war with Germany because it had this amazing conceit that it could win, that it would have the help Britain now in France, and with this kind of encirclement going on, that it would, you know, it would be victorious. So it just kept talking and pushing and making these noises and turning and getting the Polish people hepped up, and their mood heightened that, oh, they're going to, you know, have some great heroics going on and become this great Poland again and take over a lot of new territory. So on, but on April 4th, going back to then, well, this is where we went to, we were in May, then we went to March, now we're in April 4th, Moscow declared that the Soviet Union was not obliged to supply war materials to Poland, nor would it stop deliveries of its raw materials to Germany. And so on April 6th, I'm not sure if I'm having some sound problems here with my, I can't get my sound up, there it is, with the Skype, I might be having that. But if so, I guess there's nothing I can do about it. I hope it'll clear up. On 6 April 1939, Foreign Minister Beck concluded his state visit to London, and this mutual assistance agreement was agreed upon at that time. And so the Volkische Beobachter called it, the NSDAP newspaper called it, a dangerous step and a departure from the wise political course of Marshal Pilsudski that he had set, and this course could set Europe ablaze. And it criticized the mobilization of the Polish army on the border with Germany and called it a provocation, which it was. And therefore, now only Britain encouraged the Polish. Now Britain was in the act, and it was encouraging what Poland was doing by a draft law on mobilization on 26 April 1939, which would significantly facilitate the calling of reserves and auxiliaries in the future. And in a second bill, Poland introduced limited conscription for a period of 3 years, and that was in April, the end of April. So Hitler responded to this with a speech to the Reichstag, and he repealed the Anglo-German Naval Agreement and of 1935 and the German-Polish Treaty of January 1934. And then he called on negotiations with Poland to form a new treaty between the two nations. And but Poland didn't respond to this. And Poland said, no, Beck said on the 5th of May that the strengthening that he now, okay, he announced a mutual aid agreement with England, and he talked of the strengthening of the agreements with France. And at the same time, he commented on Hitler's suggestion to launch new negotiations for a future German-Polish treaty by saying they would only be possible with certain reservations and conditions. And this is the exact same language as used by Biddle on March 29th in that thing that I read earlier. So the Polish Foreign Office is like saying, you know, it's just like putting out a stock response that it had previously determined, with the help of, with the conversations with the American diplomats, and not really paying attention to what Germany is really offering them. you know, then I will add here that the Polish Foreign Office responded with this, it's a quote, "Our war generation, soaked with blood, certainly deserves a period of peace. But peace has a high, even if determinable, price. We Poles do not know the concept of peace at any price. In people's lives, as in the lives of states, only a thing is priceless, honor." And this was quoted on Saturday by Zykovits, and he said this was an example of very wrong thinking about how you should consider your, you know, your, the actions of your state, and you don't make decisions about war based on honor, he said, but this is what the Poles were doing at this time. And then there was something called telegram number 1023 on 6 April 1939 from the American embassy. It was according to it, between 1919-1926. Okay, well, there was a concern about the Germans who had left Poland because of persecution and had gone back to Germany, but I'm going to skip that because I want to get through this here. And so in May 1939, the U.S. Ambassador Biddle reported, strictly confidential for the President and the Secretary of State, he reported that, this is what he said, Hitler wanted to realize his plans for world domination with an attack on Poland in June, to be followed by a world war in September. In addition, the German high command allegedly planned a concentrated outbreak from the encirclement in the east and southeast of Germany, at the same time overrunning the Siegfried and Maginot line in the west, and a binding of French forces by the Spaniards in the Pyrenean region, that's it, that, and the use of the German Luftwaffe against England were also expected. So Biddle was putting out what he said were Hitler's plans, which were not Hitler's plans, but trying to make out that Hitler was going to be very, very aggressive and attacking everyone and starting a war, you know, starting a world war. And a second telegram in 15 May 1939 from Ambassador Biddle to Washington, informing them of the current situation and of the personality of Hitler, according to the Polish Foreign Minister Beck, and said that Warsaw, according to Beck, saw Hitler as on the defensive and helpless because the German and Austrian mentality is strong in the offensive but confused on the defensive. I just laugh at that. I mean, this is, they're trying to portray here that Hitler has gone mad, he's going berserk, he's going to start attacking everyone. And but Beck is saying that he's not being affected by this because he says he saw Hitler's inner balance disturbed by the Anglo-Polish Pact, the message of President Roosevelt to Hitler and Mussolini, which is something that was from April, a message from Roosevelt to Hitler and Mussolini. And these are things that have disturbed Hitler's inner balance. And the Anglo-Turkish Pact of May 12, 1939, and Beck's talks with the Soviet Deputy Foreign Minister Potemkin, and the refusal of the Scandinavian countries to conclude a non-aggression pact with Germany. And so Beck said that a continuation of such defeats would most likely show the German dictator his place. Now, does anyone still ask, I'm saying, why Hitler didn't try to make allies out of the Poles after defeating them, after he was forced to invade that country and go through a whole war against them and lose a lot of German soldiers in the process? And once that was accomplished, then he was supposed to make up to the Poles and consider them as some kind of allies. He knew better than to do that. And people who say this are being kind of stupid, in my opinion. According to, back to Schickel, according to Biddle, Beck was aware of the seriousness of the situation and did not exclude a war in the coming few days, yet he thought that Hitler had preserved a remnant of reason in order to avoid the utmost. Well, this is the same thing that Hitler said about the Poles afterwards. He said he thought the Poles would come to their senses and would not cause it to come to war. But they did. So this is the same thing that Beck was saying about Hitler. And he says, however, The time has come to express the will to resist unequivocally and publicly. In this connection, Beck expressed once again his satisfaction with the Anglo-Polish Pact, which was the appropriate means, in his opinion, of dealing with dictators of Hitler's type and a proper response to their aggressive policies. Okay, so now Beck is feeling fully protected by these two great powers, France and England, just like when he stayed in Hitler's shadow during the Czech crisis, you know, and now he's in this feeling protected in the shadow of England and France. But it didn't quite work out, because while Hitler carried out and stayed and also treated Poland well at that time, we found that England and France did not stay to what they had promised. And so I think I can, most of this is now known, and I don't think I have any more messages from the United States in the rest of this, but there's a lot that's interesting about Marshal Ridd Smigley and Ambassador Biddle. Okay, here's Ambassador Biddle sent another secret telegram, strictly confidential, for the President and Secretary of State in July 1939, that included an assessment from Marshal Ridd Smigley of the latest military situation, testifying to the almost inevitable development of a military conflict between Poland and Germany. So, you know, this again is where the United States is encouraging what the Polish military is saying, that it's inevitable. It's inevitable that there's going to be a military conflict. And this was in July. And then he reported, Biddle reported on the emotionally charged atmosphere of the Poles in a telegram on 9th August 1939, when he said Smidley had made it clear that the city of Danzig was centuries connected with Poland, and its economy, and that force would be met with counter-violence, that the Poles were no less patriotic than the Germans. Well, what asinine stupidity, because Danzig was a German city. What was it? 90 or 95% German population in Danzig, but the Poles insisted that it was a Polish city, and they insist that to this day. And so he said, we're going to fight for what is ours, and we're not going to, we'll counter any violence with violence of our own. And then he said afterward to American journalists, see how they deal with the Americans, to American journalist Mary Heaton Vorse, that Poland was determined to fight if Germany pursued her plans to annex Danzig. All the Poles agreed Danzig was absolutely necessary for Poland. Well, it wasn't, but furthermore, each Polish boy learned the prayer that he should be a good soldier and defend his country. We've heard that before. Everything that Ridd Smigley said was kind of ridiculous. We know what happened, but it says here, the U.S., continued to deceive Poland. Okay, from the secret telegram of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow on 24 August 1939, this is Schickel, we know that the American government has been notified a few hours after the signing of the secret additional protocol about its content. Now, this is, you know, the treaty that Germany and Soviet Union completed in August 1939, and that there was a secret additional protocol that they signed apart from the protocol that was made public. And Schickel says, considering the frankness with which the Polish government informed the U.S. officials in Warsaw on all important developments and appropriate confidentiality towards Poland by the U.S. government would have been natural to expect. But what happened was that the United States, what they're saying here is that the United States was aware from someone in the Soviet Union about this secret protocol, but they didn't inform the Poles about it or anybody else. They kept it to themselves. And so the anti-aggression front took no notice to the content of the Soviet-German additional protocol to the Hitler-Stalin Pact. U.S. President Roosevelt addressed on 25th August 1939 a message to Hitler, not in order to denounce his complicity with Stalin, but to offer his own services in a peaceful solution to the German-Polish conflict. Well, he didn't say too much about that, so I'll just go on to what is certain that the Polish government ordered general mobilization on 30th August 1939, which was an announcement of a state of war, on 30th of August 1939. And it wasn't until the evening of 31st August, after Poland failed to send an authorized representative to Berlin to receive the 16 points that Hitler had drawn up and wanted to discuss with Poland. It is on record that on the 31st of August, 1939, then, at 12:40 o'clock, the instruction went back to the German Wehrmacht to open hostilities against Poland on the 1st September 1939 at 4:45 a.m. in the morning of September 1st. Now, all this time, Hitler and his government had been waiting for an envoy from Poland to discuss this latest set of discussion points that Berlin had come up with, which were very agreeable to Poland. But they, you know, Poland had decided that it had been told now by both the United States and Britain not to cooperate, not to respond to Hitler, not to do anything. And so that's what they did. And so, actually, Hitler had no choice but to take action because he was being, he was actually being snubbed and ridiculed. So, I think, when I say, how and why the United States turned Poland, I think that this report by Alfred Schickel gives a lot of the actual evidence that it was the intervention of the United States starting in 1937 that did this, because it would not have come from Britain or France. They were looking for a way to ease tensions and keep Europe from war, and they were, they saw that, you know, they couldn't hold Germany down like they might want to, at least not at this time. And so, but it was the United States that came into the action and not only turned Poland, but turned eventually Britain too, to go along, because what else could they do? And they, with the promise always that the United States was that they wanted a war, and that the United States would come into the war after it was going on for a while, because they knew he couldn't, Roosevelt knew he couldn't get Congress to declare war at this time. So, but he promised that he would. And they wanted this war because the point, what they wanted, and what Britain wanted too, truthfully, really, was to destroy Germany as a competitive power. And certainly they wanted to destroy Hitler, but they wanted to destroy Germany. And when someone like Zajkowicz says that, they're just such good friends now, Poland and Germany, they really prefer being allied with Germany to anyone else. Well, this kind of Germany that they're talking about is not any kind of Germany that I see as a real Germany. So, yeah, they like it because Germany gives them this Germany gives them anything and everything that they want, and doesn't ask for anything for itself. I want to turn now to this latest news on looted art scam from just what appeared yesterday. And I really think this is an important story because it's revealing to us how the Jews are being catered to and in the same Holocaust way, in the same manner as with the Holocaust, in this. And also, it's also revealing to us how, what a scam the art world is and what a big build up about nothing, and how most of this art is trash and isn't worth anything, but how we have been, I mean, just like in so many other areas, the people of the world have been given this propaganda about art for so long that the modern art is really has a lot to say and is worth a lot of money, and all these modern artists are brilliant and are bringing us things that you know, that are very valuable to our culture and so on. And it's all just a big, just the same big old lie, and something that the Jews want to have going on because it benefits them. They, of course, are the main people in the art world and have been for a long time. So let's look at this. The latest from Berlin, the Munich man from whom German authorities confiscated an art trove that they believe includes Nazi looted works, broke his silence, saying he isn't willing to return any of the art to previous owners, including pieces taken from Jews. Well, I'm so happy to hear him say this. I think it's great. I don't think they're going to allow him to get away with it. I think they're going to, in some way, force him to go along. They're going to force him to sign agreements, to give up his paintings or something, or they will do whatever they can do, because the Jews, they're doing this. The Jews are getting more and more into the act of it from the German state, and the United States is pushing this. So let me just see how much of this I can cover. This Cornelius Gurlitt, 80 years old now, said, "I will not speak with them, and I won't freely give anything back. No, no." I'm so happy to hear him say that, and I hope he can continue. He says, "When I'm dead, they can do with them what they want." So he's only saying that, and he's 80 years old, he's only saying that he wants to keep his paintings. He's not going to give any of it up. But he doesn't care what happens after he dies, because he doesn't have any heirs or anybody to leave it to. So they ought to just leave it at that and let that happen. And then it would go, say, to the German government and let the German government sort it all out. But no, that's not the way they want to do it here. So it says, under German law, he is the owner of the artwork until proven otherwise. Some experts in German law even question whether authorities had a legal basis to begin disclosing the names of the works in Mr. Gurlitt's collection to the public, as they did with 25 of them so far, and now they say they're going to give out all of the ones that, at least 500 and some, that are considered to be possibly taken by the Nazis or something. It is also unclear how much longer the authorities can keep the works. And Mr. Gurlitt, in this interview that he finally gave with, I guess it was Der Spiegel or something that Der Spiegel had access to, that's where this came from. Gurlitt said, "What kind of government are they to show my private property?" You know, it's been said that they're part Jewish. But as all I've seen is that his father had a Jewish grandmother, so he would have been one quarter Jewish by that. That would make Gurlitt, Cornelius, his son, 1/8 Jewish. So that's not particularly Jewish, and it may be that he doesn't have any feeling whatsoever for being Jewish himself, and doesn't, you know, just thinks of himself as a German. And he's lived in Germany all his life. Anyway, here, the worst part of this is the United States. And it's, again, just like in what I was talking about earlier, the United States meddling and coming in and on the side of the Jews and trying to have everything, trying to force its way in what takes place. So it says there's international pressure, including from Stuart Eisenstadt, who is Secretary of State John Kerry's special advisor on Holocaust issues, who helped draft the International Norms for Wartime Art Restitution to lift the statute of limitations in such cases. What this is saying is that our Secretary of State or our Department of State has allowed this special advisor on Holocaust issues to speak for the United States or the State Department. And he's a Jew, Stuart Eisenstadt, naturally, if he's a special advisor on Holocaust issues anyway, to speak for the United States and to come out and push for more transparency and these commissions that are going to be filled with Jews to look at the whole thing and determine what should be done. And then they say that this Eisenstadt, who's not, doesn't know anything about art, helped draft the International Norms for Wartime Art Restitution. Well, when they use the word helped, you know, he was only on the committee or something, supposedly representing the Holocaust victims or something. But that doesn't mean that he knows anything about it, really. And that's where, you know, you get these people, most of these people don't know anything about it, and they don't know anything about art, and this art is not any good anyway. Most of it, some of it is, the older art, but it's a good time to, and it's amazing that they're showing this art all over in the press and so on, in the newspapers, in videos and on TV, and you see how horrible it is. You can just see how stupid and imbecilic it is, and yet nobody calls it that. They talk about, oh, this person, this artist, and this expressionist, and this one, you know, how much it's worth, and so on. And people just accept it, and a lot of people are now convinced, well, like I used to be, that it is actually good, you know, and that it's actually worth something, worth millions of dollars, or some of it just hundreds of thousands of dollars, or tens of thousands of dollars for little drawings and so on. But really, it's just absolutely ridiculous. And it's there for everyone to see what a scam this whole art world is. And it was also created, as I've said before, by Jews. Jews are the ones who turned art in this direction, and they're the ones who encouraged one another to buy it and push up the prices. And they now get these huge prices for this stuff that most people with taste don't even want and don't buy it, but these Jews all buy it, and then they trade it. And these people from these supposedly original owners of this art, these heirs, who say that the art was stolen or they were forced to sell for much less than it was worth and so on, and want this stuff returned to them, they all want to sell it. They're all going to put it up on auction at Sotheby's or Christie's or something. And they don't even want it themselves. They just want the money that they know it's worth. Some of them have said that. There's one man who is blind, and he says he wants the painting that he says is should belong to him because it belonged to some ancestor of his. And he's real old, but he can't see it, and it doesn't matter, it said, because he's going to put it up for sale right off the bat. Anyway, dear this little Mr. Cornelius Gurlitt, who I have to like for what he's standing up for and what he's being put through, he says he described losing these pictures 2 years ago when they took them away from him as more painful than the death of his father or of his mother or of his sister becoming ill with cancer. I don't know if he actually said those words, but he did say, they may have written this because he said, I've never loved anything more than my pictures in my life, including another person. He said, I don't know if he said including another person or if they said that. He said, but this is a quote, the pictures are somewhere in a basement now, and I am alone. So you know, this man has told how he's lived all his life with these pictures. Surrounded, he grew up in his parents' home. He was surrounded by these same pictures as his father's art collection. And then they gathered it all up, and they drove from Dresden to into Western Germany, and saved all the pictures. And then they lived there, and then his father died, his mother died, and he was the keeper of the pictures, and he's kept them secret. And he as we know, in any way, I read somewhere where he has a suitcase where he kept his favorite ones. And every night, he took out these favorite ones from the suitcase and looked at them before he went to bed. I mean, he lives with these paintings like they're his closest family. And he said that they sent a psychological here's good. He said, Mr. Gerlitt told Der Spiegel that about 30 government officials came to his apartment while he was still in his pajamas one morning and instructed him to sit in a chair and watch for 4 days. I guess, did he ever get up out of the chair? I don't know. Watch for 4 days while they packed up his paintings and other belongings. They later sent a psychological counselor to visit him once to ensure he wasn't suicidal. And he described this experience as horrible and dreadful. He did not want to talk to this counselor. And in the past 2 weeks, he's only left his apartment twice. And he continuously has nightmares, he says. But of course, there's no sympathy for him. There's only sympathy for these rich Jews, and I mean they are rich already, who have been deprived of their property all these years, while this man had them in his back room or whatever. But I think that they, under normal laws that are functioning in Germany right now, they belong to him. They belong to him, and they can't take them away from him. But they're going to try to pass some new laws to get over the time limit, can't think of what that's called right now, and to make it possible to take these paintings away from him for the sake of the Holocaust industry. And so he said, I've covered all that, all right. Now, I think I'll go on to... go on to this Spiegel article, another one that says, let's see where I can find this. Talking about him some more. Boy, this is long. All right. They're looking at the legal aspects of this. And is this shy 80-year-old man who has now gained worldwide notoriety truly a criminal? And if he isn't, or if he is, and his alleged crime is now past the statute of limitations, that's what I was trying to think of, do authorities have the right to continue depriving him of his art? Well, obviously the answer is no. And also, did they have the right to post images of his collection online? No, they didn't. But now they're having to answer this, and they're coming up with their doing some fast stepping. And it says, according to the Bavarian Justice Ministry, there were 1,280 paintings and drawings, and so that number of 1,400 is wrong. It was an overestimate. It's 1,280. And the collection can be divided into three groups. First, there were the pictures that Hildebrand Gerlitt sold on behalf of the Nazi dictatorship, which it classified as degenerate, and which he was expected to turn into hard currency abroad, from abroad. And the Bavarian investigators estimate that this category includes 380 of these degenerate works, which they think today in the art world considers to be great masterpieces. And then the second group consists of those works that were seized in connection with acts of persecution, that is, the so-called looted art that were stolen from their Jewish owners. You notice how they say that? They were stolen from their Jewish owners. They're all Jews. If it was stolen from somebody who wasn't a Jew, I guess it doesn't quite count. I don't know. But the Nazis confiscated entire collections, they say. Now, this is all... This is not known. They need to come up with records to prove this. This is just the propaganda that's been going around for years and years. And they forced Jewish collectors into selling them their artworks. Well, at least they did buy them. If they were forcing Jews to emigrate, then I don't know. But, you know, I mean, they have to have some proof of this. And there are some people who do, but most of the people probably don't. And that, so they say that this, some of the top Nazis obtained some of the works. I mentioned Goring last week. He was always on the lookout for classical paintings that he really liked and wanted. But, others ended up with art dealers. That would be the most of it. And Cornelius was one of them. And there were several. There was, you know, a whole group of art dealers who were dealing, working with the Nazis in buying and selling these paintings. And there's 590 of these. And then the third group includes 310. I guess that adds up to the right number. That appears to be more innocuous, that could very well belong to Hildebrand Gurlitt. Because he purchased them before the Nazi era, or they were part of his family estate. Now, you know, it's very strange that in Germany, if you purchased, my voice keeps going way down. I guess it's okay. If you purchased anything during what they call the Nazi era, or any art changed hands during the Nazi era, It's under suspicion, and it's all considered to be looted art in some way because they just consider that the Nazis were just taking everybody's art, everybody who had any, which is not, can't be true. It just can't be true, but they don't care. The article asks, is it right to treat Hildebrand Gurlitt's son as a criminal and turn him into an object of ridicule, which is true they have done? This is precisely what officials in Bavaria did when they removed and confiscated the entire art collection from his apartment. And they probably did not have the search warrant they had did not authorize them to take all of his paintings, over 1,000 of them, out of his possession. And when they released information on him, they don't have the right to do that. So we've gone over that already. Perhaps this is why the authorities are now considering leveling new charges against Gurlitt, including fraud and dealing in stolen goods. So, you know, they're looking, they've made a lot of mistakes here. They're looking very bad. The Germans are looking bad. The investigators are looking bad, and of course the Jews are trying to make them look bad, and the World Jewry and this U.S. State Department and so on. So now they've got to protect themselves somehow, and so now they're going to try to make Gurlitt more guilty than he is and accuse him of fraud and dealing in stolen goods if they can get away with it. And it says the case ultimately revolves around the culpability of the father, Hildebrand, and can the son be held responsible for his father's misdeeds? You know, there's a lot of legal questions that they're just going to try to brush over in order to turn it into this kind of like they do with the Holocaust. Just brush over people's rights, like revisionist rights, and just say that, well, we don't, you know, you don't have any rights because when it comes to this issue, the suffering of the Jews is what takes precedence over everything else. So there's more Jewish demands coming, and I've got some instances here of different personalities who are claiming things, but I don't have time to cover that, so I'm going to moving down here. Well, there's a good article in the BBC by Lucy Burns, and but it's pretty long. I had some pictures here, but they're gone. Oh, here they are. Okay, I've only got 60 seconds, ladies and gentlemen. There's never enough time to cover everything. I always try to cover more than one thing, and then I really can't do the second subject very much. But I think that I did go through what's new and what I most wanted to say, although there's still, you know, a lot of stuff here, but it might just get boring. But, you know, I want to leave you with the idea that, that this art, and I speak as someone who's pretty knowledgeable about art, this art really isn't any good. And if it was burned, who cares? If it's destroyed, and in a sense, let these Jews have it. And I guess let them trade in it and make millions of dollars off of it. Nobody should honor it. Nobody should go to museums to look at it, not to modern art museums. And so this is a story of our times, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening tonight. And tune in on Thursday and tomorrow night. And
thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.